big rocks and all that sort of thing.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello and welcome to another very special edition of the Mick Wall podcast. Welcoming back my dear friend from across the water, or as I like to refer to him, the madman across the water, Mr. Fergal Trainer of that fecking metal podcast. We've done stuff before, but he feels he has more to learn, so he's decided, you know, we should do something else together. Right, Fergal?
That's it, yeah, exactly. Thanks very much. Great to be back and chatting to you again. Hope you're well. It's been a long time now since you were over in Dublin. Seems like another lifetime ago.
I know. Well, it was last September,
yeah.
Which is too long, but... my wife still has this terrible back condition, so we can't travel at the moment, but hopefully when she gets better, we will be over there annoying you.
Disc related or what is it?
Oh yeah. No, it's what do you call it? A disc in her spine has gone.
Oh,
not
yeah.
Gone. It's slipped. That's the word. Slipped. And
nasty.
It's just the most excruciating, debilitating thing. And I don't know what the health service is like in Ireland, but over here, everything takes forever. So she did the injury last September, actually, just before we came to Dublin. And it really ruined the whole thing for her. The best night we had was with you guys at the Bleeding Horse.
Mm.
The rest of the time, she couldn't even sleep in the bed. She had to sleep on the floor. I mean, it just went on for months and months. And then eventually, after a really long time, she got to see specialists, and she's having an MRI next week, in fact.
Right, yeah.
But we've been told we might have to wait up to 8 weeks for the results. So it's just a never-ending fucking nightmare.
I had a similar thing a few years ago. I slipped a disc putting on my trousers in the morning, getting up for work, and I fell right over onto the floor and was like absolutely in bits for a long time. So yeah, I know the pain. It's not pleasant, and it's never been the same since, actually. I don't think I've ever had fully functioning back since then. Now,
well, that is the problem. Is there is no going back to normal. I just suddenly realised if I do that, I can see you.
Oh yeah, I thought you already could see me.
No, I was looking at GarageBand and working out my levels. It's very important for me to get the right level.
Absolutely, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Oh,
yeah. As you can tell from the technical mastery exhibited in my own podcasts, you know, there's never been any complaints about the levels there.
I certainly don't recall any.
No, definitely. So anyway, what are we talking about?
Well, I know we've talked about Iron Maiden before, but, you know, there's such a rich history there that you could talk about them on multiple podcasts, multiple episodes, endlessly almost, and there'd still be new things to talk about. But I wanted to have a look at the period of 1989 to 1999. During that time, most Iron Maiden fans would be aware, Adrian Smith released his first solo album, then left Iron Maiden in 1990. Bruce Dickinson released his first solo album, then left Iron Maiden in 1993. They ended up doing different things. They released some solo albums themselves. They worked together on Bruce Dickinson's albums, and then they rejoined the band. And I just wanted to look at it from somebody who was obviously writing about the band at the time. And obviously you have written the book that we are all aware of, Run to the Hills. But even to look back on it now and reflect some 20 odd years on from that time period, and what do you think led to those decisions at the time?
I can't be specific with Adrian But, you know, Adrian, what made him so great for me in Iron Maiden was that he wasn't Dave Murray or Steve Harris.
Yeah.
His sphere of influences were slightly broader, if you like. So Adrian, while loving all the rock bands, obviously those were the main things, you know, he also understood pop music and he understood that world. Whereas, you know, a lot of rock and metal fanatics are like that to the exclusion of all other music.
Mm.
And Steve and Dave, bit like that, but not Adrian. And that's what made his work intriguing, you know, when he would write with Bruce in what I like to think of as the imperial period of Iron Maiden, that first 10 years. Yeah. You know, 2 minutes to midnight. Mm. Wasted Years, what a great song. I mean, Adrian wrote all of Wasted Years on his own.
Yeah.
And then when you get to Seventh Son, again, I think his role is crucial in terms of melody, turning these kind of monolithic rock songs into stuff that sounds good on the radio and gets them in the charts. I mean, Can I Play With Madness, Evil That Men Do. There were so many great singles on that album. And I think Adrian had a lot to do with that. And I wonder
So I was going to say, yeah, he's writing credits on both of those songs, and they're certainly the popular kind of singles from that time period.
Yeah, I mean, he knew who David Bowie was, and he knew who the Rolling Stones were, and he knew all that stuff, which the rest of the band were less informed about and less interested in. The clue, I think, is in the solo album, ASAP, which I still can never remember what that stands for. But
Adrian Smith and Project, which is ridiculous name for a band, but anyway.
Listen, almost 10 minutes of thought went into that, okay? So, I can't even remember that album. I remember hearing it and thinking it was pretty good, but definitely not very Maiden-esque. And I think that's the thing about Adrian. There was a lot about him that was not Maiden-esque. You know, he was the first, possibly the only one to wear makeup on stage and off. And he'd get chastised for it by Steve, you know. And I think the thing about Somewhere in Time and then Seventh Son, it kind of made Maiden as big as they were ever going to be. But they arrived slightly too late to arrest a steady decline in sales. So for me, Seventh Son, for instance, was probably the best album they did in that period. And yet it didn't sell as well overall as Power Slave. My feeling was always, if they'd released Seventh Son after Live After Death, I think it would have been almost as big as Zeppelin. Because it had that contrast, it was Maiden through and through, but it was also exploring a little more, you know, their limits, synthesizers, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And all of which it seems ludicrous to remind us now, but we're sort of frowned.
Oh, absolutely. Sure, there's the famous
keyboards, you know.
Yeah. The famous Bruce Dickinson quote, you can't play heavy metal on synthesizers. I think that was only like from 1984, around that time, and a couple of years later.
Just as Eddie Van Halen was writing Jump, you know.
Yeah, exactly. One of the biggest songs of all time.
So I think there was a... I think it was a... For me, it wasn't like one thing with Adrian. I think there was a genuine journey where he perhaps felt he'd done all he could and wanted to try other stuff.
Hmm.
At the same time, being somewhat aware that perhaps they had peaked in terms of I mean, what's the main reason for staying in any job? You know, the money's good, you feel like you're going somewhere. And then something changes and these things aren't as exciting as they used to be. You're looking at what other people are doing. You want to do that too. And I think maybe Adrian just thought that was a good moment to bow out. None of us in 1988 could imagine talking about Iron Maiden as an ongoing concern in 2023. It was just...
Yeah. It seems insane to think at the time that they'd still be around.
And he was, what, late 20s? And I think they still felt they had their life ahead of them. They still had options. They still had things they wanted to do that weren't necessarily to do with platinum records or gold singles.
Hmm.
So I think maybe that was Adrian. Bruce...
Do you think...
Go on.
Before we move on to Bruce, sorry, do you think, Adrian, so you mentioned some of the songs there that he wrote, and you've got like Wasted Years, very commercial sounding song, probably the most commercial sounding thing they'd done by that point. Then the next album, they had The Evil That Men Do, Can I Play With Madness. These were top 10 singles in the UK. Do you think that was more where Adrian wanted to be musically, and maybe he was a bit confined within Iron Maiden for the types of songs he wanted to write? Because I remember a part in your book where there was a quote from Rod Smallwood that said something like, I was always a little concerned with having too much input from Adrian. So do you think that he felt like maybe shackled in the band to some degree?
As one of the creative, the main creative influences, it reminds me a bit of Izzy Stradlin in Guns N' Roses. You know, he wasn't that full-on believer like Slash and Axl. But that's why he was such an important ingredient, because he wasn't that. But he brought this other thing, this more kind of groovy rock and roll thing. And it made it more intriguing. You know, it was just another element. And when you take that away, you lose something. And the emphasis becomes more on all the other stuff that you know you can do. I think maybe as well, I mean, Adrian's very indecisive, you know, incredibly, he's not a man of action, if you see what I mean. He will think about things for a long, long time. But there was a period after Seventh Son when it did look as if Maiden had somewhat peaked and were on the other side of the rainbow now, because, you know, Guns N' Roses... opened on the Seventh Son tour. I saw some of those shows and it was chalk and cheese. You know, there was no overlap. To the point where Axl Rose was mortified that he was having to be on the Iron Maiden tour. And when they came to Irvine Meadows in 88, two nights there in LA, he just didn't turn up. You know, he hurt his voice. The doctor said, yada, yada, yada. He just didn't turn up because he didn't want to, in LA, his hometown. And of course, by then he's saying, we're bigger than them anyway.
Yeah.
Which they were by that point. You've also got Megadeth, Metallica, Anthrax, Slayer. You know, there really was this... Maiden were a little bit in the rearview mirror at this point, particularly in America. In the same way that I suppose Deep Purple and Black Sabbath would have felt in the 80s, you know. They're not Iron Maiden, they're not AC/DC.
Yeah.
And I think I sort of doubt Adrian thought it through that much, but if he had, that would have been the optimal moment to leave. Because it's the highest profile. You're jumping out of the ship before it has sunk. So you can make an equitable move. And people go, fair play. He did his tour of duty, gave us some great moments, and now he's off doing something else. But of course, it didn't pan out because Adrian isn't a front man.
Yeah.
And as I say, he's not a great leader or decision maker. And if you want to be a success in anything, including rock music, you need that kind of personality and that kind of drive and that vision, even if it's a bit warped, if someone has to have an idea of what they, strong idea of where you're going and what you want to do. So I suspect Adrian thought, yeah, Mick Ralphs left Mott the Hoople and formed Bad Company. You know, I mean, people do move on. It's very common in the 60s and 70s. You know, nearly all the great bands of the 70s came out of the remnants of 60s leftovers, whether it was Rod Stewart or Elton John or David Bowie. So I don't think it was... I think it was, from his point of view, probably a good moment to bow out. They were going to have a long break. They weren't doing as well as they used to do in America.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it just seemed like it's now or never.
And he did stick around for some of the writing of No Prayer for the Dying, which was framed at the time as a Back to Basics album. Probably one of the least remarkable albums that Iron Maiden ever released. But yeah, he has one writing credit on that for the song Hooks in You, but he left basically at the time. And you were saying, like, kind of after Seven Son is a perfect time to bow out, but it seemed like he may have intended to stay, but then when it came to this kind of Back to Basics approach, he just wasn't having any of it then, after doing something like Seven Son.
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but none of them enjoyed working on that album for the simple reason that they were working out of Steve Harris's brand new home studio. Home studios at that time were still regarded as, I suppose, like self-published books. You know, it's doesn't mean the book is bad, but it just doesn't signal major investment and epic profile. I mean, Maiden had been going out, you know, the Bahamas to make records.
Yeah, it's not exactly Compass Point in wherever that was.
No, if you read the book, you'll see Bruce complaining that it wasn't even a very good studio. It meant Martin Birch had also retired, so it now meant Steve was essentially producing the album. And like Bruce said... it's a long time since I wrote the book, but from memory, he said something about, you know, it was like it wasn't quite finished and you'd record down there, then you'd have to run up some stairs and check the, you know, what they were doing in the... and there was no interaction. You couldn't look through the glass into the studio because you were up there. Mm. And he just said it was, you know, this running up and down. It was sort of a loft or something, you know. It does sound quite Back to Basics, but that was also to do with trying to save money. You know, these huge albums had cost fortunes to make.
Yeah.
But they suddenly weren't selling like they used to. And, you know, there's the moment where your first album sells so much, your second does a bit better, your third does better. It's all investment. They'd plateaued. Sales-wise, they had plateaued.
Mm.
And Adrian's gone. We better batten down the hatches. Steve wants to work in his own studio, which means he wants it more his own way. And I think all of them felt very, you know, it's not the Bahamas. There's no Martin Birch reigning Steve in.
Well, Martin Birch did produce that one. No Prayer. And the next
did
one.
Did he?
Yes. And then he was
get
finished.
The fuck.
No, he did. Yeah.
I bet you sure Steve's not listed as co-producer?
He probably is on there, all right. But yeah, no, it was I think Martin Birch's second last Iron Maiden album was No Prayer. And then he did Fear the Dark, and then that was it.
Really? Well, I think the idea was that it's at Steve's house. It's always been Steve's band. Mm. And I think it just... it wasn't favourable. No one liked it. You know, they went from Whistlelord Studios and Compass Point, and now it's Steve's shed in the garden. You can't even fucking see in the studio. You've got to run upstairs and crouch, you know. Mm. Bruce, Steve and Adrian were the creatives. Dave Murray come up with one song every few years, and it'd always be the same song, bless him, you know. Nico, zero input in terms as a songwriter, just his own very unique drumming style. So whether Nico was having a good day or a bad day, you know what he's going to sound like. Same with Davey, except Davey never had bad days that you noticed. Adrian Bruce, for sure, felt that they had more to their talents than just churning out Iron Maiden material. And this was their moment. Maiden had plateaued, was just starting to look overside. The studio's crap, the vibe is crap. Good time to leave.
So then, Bruce, we move on to Fear of the Dark. Adrian has left and Yannick Gerz is the new guitarist. So No Prayer for the Dying gets released. They actually have a big hit single with Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter, but I don't think it's particularly well received by people at the time. And then Fear of the Dark comes out then in 92. And they do a tour. At this point, Bruce has released his first solo album as well, Tattooed Millionaire, in 1990. They do a tour, and they have a second tour planned in 93. And between those two tours, Bruce Dickinson decides to quit. What do you remember hearing about this at the time? Was this something that you saw coming?
I didn't see Adrian leaving. I did see Bruce leaving, going way back. Him and Steve absolutely never got on. You know, I've told you this before. They wouldn't even sit next to each other on the plane. They wouldn't do interviews together. I'm sure Bruce would have, but Steve wouldn't. Used to call him the chimp. Right. He looked like Bill Oddie in those days. I mean, that Seventh Son tour, Steve didn't even travel on the bus with them. He had his own bus with his wife and kids and nanny and helpers, and then the other bus was the other guys.
So
Steve had increasingly cocooned himself so that, you know, he was never outside his comfort zone. And I think what Bruce in particular felt strongly was that they had to go beyond that in order to become a Led Zeppelin, in order to become a legend, as opposed to Motorhead or Uriah Heep, or, you know, these bands that just go on and on and on ploughing the same furrow. Bruce and Steve never got on. By the time you get to the end of the Seventh Son tour, Bruce is working on his first novel. He likes to go fencing. You know, he wants to pilot an aeroplane. I mean, all this stuff was considered a fucking joke within the circles of the band. You know, of course he wants to be a fucking pilot. You know, it's Bruce. He probably wants to be a ballroom dancer as well. You know, it's, oh, he's an author. Oh, of course he is. What can't he do? You know. But Bruce had his own fans and his own scene and his own yes men. And his own ambitions. And he gave it a go. You know, by the end, like Fear of the Dark, that time, they you know, they had a fight. Steve knocked him out. Steve was going through a divorce.
Go back there for a second. They put a physical, a fist fight.
Yeah. That final tour, according to Steve and many of the others, Bruce wasn't even trying. He was doing the classic Gillan. He wouldn't even do the words, you know.
Yeah.
Six sisses, nah, ha, he, ho, ba, da, ba, di, ba, di, di. You know, they said if you could hear it back through the desk, and Steve would be going, that fucking cunt, what's wrong with him? You know. And it was, he lost the will to live. He hated being there. In Europe, he'd be flying home to London every opportunity. I think Steve was still doing tax exile thing in Portugal. So, and there was one occasion where Bruce, I don't know if this was the same thing or two different times, but same period, same tour. Bruce had gone back to London and bumped into Steve's wife.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
And when he got back, you know, he was doing that horrible thing. Oh, I saw so-and-so, you know. Yeah, she looked good. Oh, no, we had a great life. You know, all that stuff, you know, fuck off, man. You know what I mean? Fuck off. Now, I don't know if it was the same show or another one, but literally that time, he got back from London late. You know, the plane had been delayed and so I think they still did the gig, but he literally arrived in the dressing room as they should be about to go on stage.
Yeah.
And as he walked in, Steve just punched him straight in the face.
Wait, I don't think I've ever heard this before.
And he went down. He went down. I had him. Steve doesn't speak like that, by the way. A little bit like that. No, you wouldn't want to get a fucking punch in the face from Steve Harris. Not in those days.
Yeah.
Not now, but in those days, definitely not. You know, tattooed millionaire, you know, the calling the album that. That was a song that specifically was about criticizing Steve. Because okay. Bruce has never had a tattoo and Bruce never had a tattoo.
I thought it was a bit Nikki Six, but anyway.
No.
No? All right, okay.
No, that was the cover story.
Right.
And that was because Nicky fucked his wife.
Yeah. Well, that's what I thought. Yeah.
And then not only that, but because Bruce had shown Nicky some fencing, and obviously that was humiliating. Imagine Nicky Six fencing. Dude! That was my ass! You know, dude, I'd do some Krell, then we'll pick up the swords, man. So Nicky, who could box, then took Bruce boxing and beat the shit out of him. Dude, I'm so sorry. I just don't know my own strength. No, the tattooed millionaire was Steve and Nico and Davey. Bruce was ex-public schoolboy. One of the very first times I stood in their dressing room, he was warming up for the gig by on guard, you know, doing some... Everybody was standing going, oh, fucking hell. You know,
yeah.
What's he doing? You know, why is he doing it?
So you're saying basically anyway that you could have foreseen him leaving Iron Maiden eventually because of all these things you mentioned, all of the extracurricular activities and the personality clash.
He in many ways correctly perceived himself as being more than just the singer of Iron Maiden. And when he would go around, you know, I accompanied him on a lot of these things. I got him his deal with the publisher to be an author, God help me. I remember hooking him up with the BBC and all these London publishers and the BBC, you know, they loved him. because they were expecting some Grebo who couldn't string a sentence together. Mitchell! You know, and he came in and was articulate and could have a proper conversation about stuff that wasn't Iron Maiden. And so he became their go-to guy. He's lovely. Have you met? Oh no, I was with Bruce. I love that guy. You know, it's all that shit. Whereas perhaps, you know, they wouldn't have felt the same affinity, you know, with Nico.
Yeah.
So you know, Bruce was very much encouraged to believe he was a Renaissance man, and that he'd kind of outgrown Iron Maiden. We see it, you know, so it happened with David Lee Roth. David Lee Roth, you know, what made him so great, one of the things that made him so great was he clearly had more going on than just being Kevin DeBrow or Blackie Lawless. You know, he really had a brain, and it was that extra spark that made Van Halen a little bit more special than other heavy rock bands of their era. So this, you know, Axl and Guns, although he wasn't at all well educated, but you know, getting rid of all the band because he felt he had a vision that went beyond public perception. It's a regular occurrence. I've suffered from it. I spent years trying not to be the heavy metal writer. and then eventually I just gave up because I couldn't earn any money doing anything else.
Yeah.
And that's what happened with these guys, in essence, in the end, yeah.
So when Blaze Bayley joined Iron Maiden as the singer for The X Factor, did you feel that this was a stopgap? Did you feel that it was the long-term solution for the band?
I thought it was an inspired appointment at the time because I'd been a big Wolfsbane fan. And Blaze was all energy. You know, Wolfsbane were always sort of compared like an English Van Halen, you know.
Yeah.
And they had that same kind of humour and charisma. And Blaze would scurry about the stage and antics and fall over and just be incredibly larger than life. So I just thought, shrewd, you know. I was a bit sad for Wolfsbane because it meant the end of them. But, you know, there you go. So I thought it was a good choice. But, you know, no Adrian, no Bruce. You know, Yannick is... I first met Yannick when he joined Gillan in 1981. And I remember in those days... You know, Gillan were a rock band. To normal people, they'd have thought they were heavy metal.
Yeah.
But the only one who had long hair was Ian Gillan. He had long hair down to his waist. But everybody else in those days had short hair, including Bernie Torme, the previous guitarist, had an eye patch and spiky hair. He could have been a punk, you know. And Yannick joined with no makeup, no eye patch, no hair product. Just straight long hair. I remember in the very first tour program, because I wrote it, everybody, you know, has lots to say. Each member gets to say stuff. And then it comes to Yannick, and he just went, "I have long hair." And that was it. And it was brilliant. It summed it up. It totally summed up why he was going to be a hero in that band. So I always liked him and always rated him. But for me, it was a bit like now having two Dave Murrays in the band. Both great guitarists, both soloists.
Yeah.
But apples and apples. Whereas when Adrian was in there, apple and orange, you know, you had that frisson, that extra thing that made them special.
Yeah.
When it worked. But now no Bruce either. To me, I thought, well, this really is now the Steve Harris solo band. There's no one really challenging him. And there's no one coming in with songs better than his.
yeah.
You know, which Adrian and Bruce are able to do, or certainly as good. And so I didn't really know what to expect, but it was actually, you know, commercially, it was a disaster.
Yeah.
They were now completely dead in the water in America and many other places. It was as if they'd broken up.
Then were you surprised to see Adrian Smith join up with Bruce Dickinson for Accident of Birth in 97, which to most people sounded like an Iron Maiden album?
I was working as Bruce's PR
okay.
in 96. Straddling the period, and I can't remember what it was called. He did an album. Is it Mark Z or something?
Roy Z.
He did an album with Roy Z, which I worked on, and I really liked that album. But it was kind of like Bruce Dickinson sings Santana. Roy Z, I loved Roy Z, and I thought that was a great record. But it was very kind of, I like Santana.
Hmm.
You know, I like instrumental music. I like all kinds of music. So for me, it was like, interesting. Yeah, you know. It sold fuck all, was a complete disaster commercially. And Bruce himself told me that I think they wouldn't even release it in Japan.
Okay.
Yeah, it got to the stage now where these really are like self-published books. I'm on an indie label, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It would come out here and a certain amount of fans would get it, but it was making no sense anywhere. We're now in the time when grunge has taken over, new metal is on the way. And if you don't like any of that, well, here's Oasis. You know, they when they needed to be at their strongest, they were at their weakest. And Bruce didn't have the name. He didn't have that heft, the credibility or the commerciality. So he told me that there was no real encouragement for him to do another solo album. By that, what you mean is, who's going to pay me money to do it? Who's going to promote it? Who's going to invest in a new Bruce Dickinson album? And no one was interested. We could make it cheap, you know. And then the message came back from Japan. If you make a record that is like Iron Maiden, we promise you we will sell this in Japan.
Okay, right.
And so he rang Adrian, whose own career had gone right down the shitter, and said, look, it reminds me a bit of me and John Houghton, you know, when I get an offer to do a certain book that, you know, only coming out in Japan or something, you know, I'll get me old mucker in, we'll bash that out, no fucking problem. Bingo, ka-ching, thank you very much, sayonara. So he called Adrian, just said, look, I've got this much money, I'll give you this much, we'll write some fucking songs. What else are we doing? But people really liked that record, and they went, fuck, he's still got it. This could be made. This is better than Maiden.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it was, but it was better than the Blaze Maiden, because I was quite surprised when I finally got to see Blaze, how the whole thing was reduced.
Hmm.
So I saw them at Nottingham Rock City. And I think the time I'd seen them previously had either been at Donington in 88 to 106,000 people, or the two nights at Irvine Meadows, which was 18,000 people a night. And now they're at Nottingham Rock City, which, it's a club.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a big club. It's a big, rocking, great venue. But how many does it hold? 1,500? 2,000? And Blaze didn't move. He didn't move. He was completely still at the mic. And I was told later that was because in Wolfsbane, he was able to do his thing and run around and be out of breath. But in Maiden, particularly with the Bruce material, he really had to bring his voice.
Yeah.
Can you imagine trying to sing Bruce Dickinson's songs?
Oh, absolutely not. No.
Yeah. I mean, run to the what's that, Blaze?
Yeah, he had his work cut out for him.
He really did, poor guy. And he never quite, he was never quite accepted, particularly by the roadies, which is, that's a real sign of, that's a real barometer on where you are in the hierarchy. So the confluence, really, of X Factor not doing so good. There was a certain novelty value. People wanted to hear what it sounded like. But then by the next album, Virtual 11, you know, that sold even less. I couldn't even name you a track off it. I used to be able to name one or two, but...
Angel and the Gambler.
How's it go?
Don't you think I could save your life?
Sorry, how's it go?
I'm not doing it again.
Fergal Bailey there, folks. So what is that? That's 98, and the Adrian and Bruce Maiden album comes out in 97. So by the time you get to the end of 98, because they weren't even, they couldn't get arrested in America anymore. No promoters would book them. The record label wouldn't push the records. And Rod literally said, look, you tell me what you need. And they said, well, we need Bruce back. So that's what they did. That's what Rod did. He went and got Bruce back.
And
Bruce said, I'll come back if Adrian comes too. And Steve said, that's okay as long as Yannick stays.
Yeah, fair enough. But do you remember when this all started? To me, like, these things would take quite a while to put together. You'd have contracts and all this type of legal stuff probably and various things like that. But like it's framed kind of when the story's been retold as well. Steve met Bruce in a pub. They sat down and they had a conversation and they put the band back together. But like, would wheels have been in motion earlier than that or months earlier, like in 98?
Yeah, because the whole idea was this was going to relaunch Iron Maiden. It was a bit like that episode of Dallas where for a whole season, Bobby is dead.
Oh, yeah.
And it's such a fucking disaster when the new season begins with him coming out of the bathroom. It was all a dream. Blaze was all a dream. That was the strategy. And it's not at all that Bruce and Adrian are desperate because they've got no career either. No, sir. This is love of metal. Don't forget, Rod still managed all of them. You know, he was Iron Maiden's manager. He was Bruce Dickinson's manager. He was Adrian Smith's manager.
Yeah.
And they were having, they couldn't get in the game. You know, there was talk about doing a tour with Judas Priest. Well, that's not going to fly unless Bruce is in the group. You know, will you be at the next Rock in Rio or Donington or whatever it is? You just couldn't get in those spaces anymore. And that was partly because, I mean, even Kerrang! Magazine, who'd been synonymous with Iron Maiden throughout the 80s, they weren't doing metal anymore. You know, I had a hell of a time trying to get them to even do Dio or Lemmy, who I also was doing PR for at the time, because it was all grunge all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the first issue of Classic Rock was October 98. And I couldn't get a single record company to send us albums to review.
Right.
That sort of rock, that old, what we called classic rock, that old-fashioned rock, that's dead. Didn't you know that? It died when Nevermind came out. Dude, it's been over a long time. What's wrong with you? And of course it wasn't. It was actually the beginning, right at the beginning of the whole classic rock thing becoming a real industry.
Yeah.
It was back before labels ditched the idea of pushing music forward and just went into catalogue, box sets, tours where you tour the classic album, you know, all that stuff was in the future.
Yeah.
But it was fairly obvious it was coming to people that knew, but most people didn't know. So that they were all, Iron Maiden and Bruce and Adrian, they were all completely off the radar by the end of 98. And literally, it's only Rod Smallwood was the only person in the whole of the business that gave Classic Rock magazine 2 seconds of his time.
Mm.
That was mainly because all his bands couldn't get in any of the other magazines, which is how he ended up with the exclusive on Bruce and Adrian rejoining the band. But it was very much, you know, there was just nothing you could do with that machine until you'd put those pieces back together. Now suddenly we've got a fighting chance.
Yeah. And then talking about the whole kind of classic rock as an industry, record companies relying on catalogues, themed tours, all that type of stuff. How important was the reformation of Iron Maiden with Bruce and Adrian in that whole movement? Would it be in the same situation now if they hadn't got back together and had been successful?
I don't know. I think that stuff would have happened anyway.
Okay.
I think Maiden rode in on that horse very shrewdly, well executed. And why not? You know, the only invite, the only condition of membership to that club is that you really did put out all these great albums. You really were this awesome band in their time. And we now celebrate that. You know, enough time has gone past where you're no longer uncool or out of date. You're back, baby.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember being... I used to do a radio show every Friday for the BBC in London. And it was a no-budget, very low-key thing, but it was the BBC and it was London's local BBC. And I remember some of the stuff. It was a Friday night. I used to start at 8 on a Friday night. Of course, it's Friday night, so people are going out. I remember this group of people that worked there burst through the door at about 8:15. And they were so excited to tell me they were off to see Black Sabbath. Because I did the rock show, rock and metal show. Yeah. It was like, guess where we're going? Black Sabbath. It was, to them, it was like, yeah. I don't even know if they'd ever bought any Black Sabbath records. It was just,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Or Kiss.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just one of those, you know? And I was like, really? I didn't want to break their hearts. But at that point, the only member of Black Sabbath that was in Black Sabbath was Tony Iommi. The singer was, what was he? The cat. What
Tony Martin.
Name? Tony, yes. The singer was Tony Martin. The bass player was Neil Murray. The drummer was Cozy Powell. And the keyboard player was Don Airey. I mean... basically, Tony Iommi and all the fucking regulars from everybody else's albums. Not Black Sabbath. But they were we're going to see Black Sabbath. I remember it with Quo in about... I did some work with them in like 2002 or something. And they came to Oxford, near where I live, and they did the New Theatre, which is a small concert venue. And the place was packed with students from Oxford University. I couldn't understand it. And then I cottoned on as the gig went on. I could sort of get the vibe. So bad, it's good. Where are you going tonight? We're going to see Status Quo. Yeah! It was that sort of thing.
Mm.
And I think Maiden have totally earned the right to be that. And I think the 90s were really problematic for them because, you know, Ozzy couldn't get onto Perry Farrell's thing, Lollapalooza.
Oh, yeah.
Because he wasn't cool enough. So that's why Sharon, who's very bloody minded, started Ozfest, Well, Maiden were even less cool than Ozzy, you know. I mean, Ozzy had a certain cachet with cool people. But Maiden, it was just tremendously... It's what made them so brilliant in the 80s was they were defiantly long-haired metal.
Hmm.
But by the mid-90s, it was what kind of made them so unappealing to anybody that wasn't like that.
Sure, yeah.
Bruce and Adrian were the ones that helped re-establish that.
So thinking then, you know, you were saying in 1988 nobody had any notion that Iron Maiden would still be a going concern in 2023. What do you think it would take now to finish Iron Maiden?
Well, infirmity, illness and death. I mean, Steve's got to be, what, 66 now?
I think so, yeah.
Bruce, we know, you know, has had cancer. I'm the same age as those guys. Bruce and I are the same age. And those are the big ones. The other ones that stalk us of a particular generation are things like just not giving a fuck anymore, you know? I mean, or just not wanting to... Because touring is very arduous, even at the top end.
And do you think, if Nico stepped away, do you think they'd continue? We got a new drummer. Do you think, is it just Steve and Bruce you think are the irreplaceable members at this point, or do you think other people leaving would cause them to stop?
I think if Nico left, they would, if they wanted to, it'd be very easy for them to get another drummer. I think if Dave Murray left, I don't think they'd get another guitarist. I think they'd just carry on with the two. Because three is too much. Let's be honest, you know. If Bruce was to leave, I think that might be it.
Yeah.
And obviously, Steve, there's no leaving with him. It's his band.
True, you know, of course.
It's his ball that they're playing with. So if he goes home, there is no game.
Yeah.
But I think they're at that stage where, you know, why would anybody leave? I mean, they don't work that hard, do they? I mean...
Well, I know, yeah, but I mean, even just yourself there saying maybe just not wanting, maybe not giving a shit, enough of a shit to be going on tours anymore.
Well, it's true, but they don't do the tours like they used to do. I mean, you know, the tours they did in the 80s were insane.
Hmm.
And now it's just big show, couple of days off, big show, couple of days off. And also that whole classic rock market has matured in terms of how you put a tour together, how the promoters put the facilities together. You know, you don't need to see anybody you don't like until you're on stage.
Yeah.
And the stages are so big, you don't even have to... I mean, look at Motley Crue, you know, they can do what they want to do. They're not even playing half the time and they can do what they want to do.
Yeah, it's true.
Maiden do play. And I think they love what they do, but I personally don't think there'll be a big announcement. I think probably it will just be festivals and, you know, that sort of managing things so they can end without a big fuss.
Sure, okay.
They keep saying they're going to retire. They keep saying this next album's the last one.
Hmm.
And so far it hasn't been.
Well, one thing I always remember is from, I think it was an issue of Classic Rock in 2003, and Steve Harris said, I won't be doing this in my 60s, although when I was in my 30s, I said I wouldn't be doing this in my 40s. and now he's staring his 70s in the face.
Exactly. Mick Jagger is now 80 years old.
Mm.
80. 80. And of course, Keith Richards actually died back in 72, and he's still going.
Yes. Very good. All right. Well, look, that was a great chat. Nice to cover that period of the band. I find it's a really interesting time period. And it almost seems inevitable that, like, Bruce and Adrian did rejoin. But there was a few years there where it wasn't looking particularly good. And then they just really turned it around. But probably one of the biggest turnarounds ever in rock music, I think.
Well, they've always been incredibly authentic. You know, Steve leaves nothing on the table. He puts it all into the music. And we live in an age now where we, it's not like, well, do they have a new record? You got to go and see Maiden. Do they have a new record out? Who cares? Do you want to see Iron fucking Maiden before you die? Yeah, it's bucket list time. And let's be fair, they've always been a fantastic live band. I mean,
yeah,
that's how I kind of fell in love with them in the 80s, was seeing them live. I had a younger brother who was crazy about them from the word go. So I knew they were good. But seeing them live, wow. Wow.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
How do I stop this, Fern?